Hello, I'm Eamon.
I'm Conrad.
And I'm Peter.
And we are
Mega City Film Club.
Well, we're back with a film club episode, and we welcome to the film club Peter McKinney from episode 254, Big Dave, a challenging choice for the book club, but one I think we got through all right, Peter.
We did, yes, yeah. It's a tricky one, but we got through it all right. Thank you for having me on for that as well.
Well, no trouble at all, and thank you for coming back with a suggestion for the film club, which we're going to get to in a moment because it's a fascinating film to talk about. But before that, we have to get to
Film One, Thunderbolts.
Marvel's Thunderbolts, directed by Jake Screa, from a script by Eric Pearson and Joanne Carlo, starring Florence Pugh, David Harbour, Sebastian Stan, and just about everybody else, I think. And full disclosure, we're not going to do too many spoilers for Thunderbolts. I haven't seen it, so I'm waiting till it turns up on Disney Plus at the end of August. But you two have seen it. Conrad, you quite wanted to talk about this one.
Yeah, shocking, Eamon, not having seen Thunderbolts, which I thought was like pretty decent as far as these ones go. Like, I feel like if I had given you a time machine for your 2025 comic book movies, I would have rather you have waited for Captain America, Brave New World to watch on streaming and have you see Thunderbolts, I guess, which might be faint praise, but like, I thought it was, you know, it was a fun little movie. Like, you know, it's sort of another one of the, like, Fast and the Furious style, like, oh man, like, we got a team, but teams are sort of like family, and families can be nice or something like that. And, you know, just the eternal message of, like, sometimes it's satisfying when you can sort of make the concept of depression have a physical manifestation you can punch in the face, you know?
Yeah.
Peter, you've seen this film as well, and you said to compare it to the film we're going to get to in a moment, that it is quite sad and downbeat, this Thunderbolts movie.
Yeah, interestingly, like, I think they're very different films, but thematically that there is like a sadness at the core of both of them. I think Conrad was very adequate there about punching depression in the face. I like Thunderbolts. I did feel like it was watching like a Radiohead song come to life in some respects. And sometimes you have to be in the mood to. I mean, I love Radiohead, but even I have to be in the mood sometimes to listen to them. And I felt a bit like that about this film, actually. So, but I did enjoy it when I went to see it.
Florence Pugh is sort of taking over the Scarlett Johansson role in the Marvel movie cinematic universe. She has that weird movie star charisma that everything she's in, she's sort of like really good and very watchable, isn't she?
Yeah. Okay, please, Peter.
she's definitely got, what do the kids call it, the Riz.
Yeah.
So, there's definitely, and I think, yeah, she's a great successor to obviously like the original Black Widow, she was in the Falcon. What was she? She was in the Hawkeye TV show, and she was good in that, wasn't she as well? But I think they really set her out from the start. I think the first thing we see is that right, Cameron? Remind me. She jumps off that really tall building.
Jumps up the sides of a big building, and then sort of gets in a big gunfight and blows up a place and stuff like that. Yeah.
So she's got the action chops. And I think as well that she actually did jump. That isn't as – correct me if I'm wrong. And she pushed to do that. So it's pretty impressive. That is a very impressive start to the film. And it kind of – it sort of – that pop of action does get you into it very quickly. So, yeah. And actually, I guess it's her emotional journey through the film itself that takes us all with it, I think, because there's plenty of action and there's some good jokes, but it's because we believe, I believe in that character enough. So it's really sort of a movie in many respects.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, something I kind of joke about this sort of era of Marvels, that I have not been doing my homework basically for a lot of these things. So, like, you know, I haven't watched a lot of the Disney Plus shows and that kind of stuff. I feel like there was a period actually before we started doing the film club movies, even, that I hadn't watched a couple of the Marvel movies and stuff. So I really came into this one pretty blind for a lot of the, especially for Florence Pugh's character. Actually, I hadn't really seen her, her role in this role before. But I thought she really did a good job of sort of being like the emotional lead and the lead, you know, and sort of the leader of the team and stuff, and that kind of stuff. She has some really good emotional moments. Or there's definitely one really good scene with her and David Harbour as her father and stuff. And yeah, it was just generally, yeah, like a winning performance, I would say. And then maybe interest to see where they'll go with this character. And I guess sort of, yeah, you know, where things are going sort of for Marvel, I guess, because that's sort of what, part of what this one's doing is kind of setting up a little bit of a status quo for, you know, Fantastic Four this summer, basically, which sort of is going to be the big tentpole that is coming up for sure.
Yeah, I felt as well. It was a bit of a soft reboot for the MCU, which has kind of lost its, it's been a bit wibbly wobbly, mm-hmm. kind of lost its way. And they address like the lack of the Avengers, don't they, in the film?
Yeah.
So, without giving spoilers away, the conversations throughout the film, like, you know, where are they? And I think lots of audiences, I've been asking that question, like, where have they been? And for lots of complicated reasons, we haven't had an Avengers film since 2019, I think. So it's interesting the way it does that as well. Like, it sort of like mm-hmm. resets everything slightly as well, which is, and sort of sets things up, like, you're right, Fantastic Four and the coming films. So that was good. What did you think of the way they did the century, Conrad?
I thought it was really, yeah, it was an interesting way to take the character, I guess. I know a little bit about Century from the comics. Like, I think for because he's sort of a newer character, I thought it was really interesting how they sort of, you know, you see like the specific focus group testing for like his costume and look in like pieces of paper and stuff like that, you know. And then, you know, when, and there's sort of, you know, eventually kind of turns evil and becomes this like blackness or something. And that was really horrifying.
Yes.
Like, I feel like that was actually, was a really good job of making a threat that's like scary, I guess, in terms of just having this figure that's all black and just turns people into blast shadows, basically. And just, you see him just wiping people out, like all down the streets of New York and stuff. That was really awesome for sure.
Yeah, it was almost like there'd been a nuclear bomb went off when people disappeared and all that was like.
Yeah,
that
was very, well, they said, I remember reading production things and they did take like inspirations from like in like Hiroshima or something like that. There were actual, like, you know, those the shadows of people that had been hit by the bomb sort of left behind on walls and stuff. And that was sort of some inspiration for the look of it, I guess. And just, I mean, sort of going back to my original joke, I guess, like the, you know, I actually kind of recommended this movie to a couple friends of mine who have had sort of some mental health struggles, I guess, because that is a big central part of the movie, mm-hmm. I suppose, is sort of this character who sort of struggles with mental health and then also gets sort of this great superhero power and sort of has to deal with it and stuff. And I think it has sort of not, you know, not like ultra nuanced or like, you know, like a, like incredible way of handling it, but an interesting way of handling it, I think. And something that I know people who have struggled with that sort of as someone who struggled with that kind of stuff themselves, I guess I found kind of something. I found I could relate to it within the Century character in a way that I think is unusual for a superhero movie, which is sort of, you know, so much can be a power fantasy and not so much a consequences fantasy, which is what this one seemed to be kind of.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And I think the way they introduce him and build up Bob, mm-hmm. is really good, because you get to know him a little bit, and then we learn more about him, and then so when he turns into the Sentry and the consequences of his demise, I think the audience have a better understanding. Yeah,
and definitely.
I also felt the way the Sentry deals with people, it reminded me a bit of something from a DC comic, the Doom Patrol, written by Grant Morrison, where they have something called the Tea Room of Despair, where people get sent to the Tea Room of Despair forever, and they get tortured by their worst fears. And actually, that's what the Sentry does to people. So
yeah, totally.
Which I really liked. I mean, it's unintentional, but I quite like that. And it was a good way of getting around the fact that actually the Sentry is totally overpowered. Like, he's just...
Right. Yeah, it is. Yeah. And, you know, it did sort of answer sort of the joke they make themselves, where it's like, listen, like, you know, what can we do? Like, we just punch and shoot. Like, they are our team, you know, like, it's not like, you know, when you compare it with sort of the original movie Avengers and stuff, they are a pretty street level team as compared to, like, you know, gods and flying golden men and things like that, you know, for sure.
Yeah, there's that bit sort of when they're trying to fight him, and like at the end, Bucky's like, right, I'm taking. He sort of strips down to just like to the most basic clothes, and like, this is it, I'm going to go in for it. And it's totally pointless. And it's quite a funny moment. I don't know if it's meant to be, but I thought it was. So yeah, totally. overall, lots of fun actually. So.
I had a good time with Thunderbolts. Would recommend checking it out on streaming and stuff like that.
Yeah, same here. Probably one of the stronger MCUs of the last couple of years.
So Marvel's Thunderbolts will be coming to streaming sometime towards the end of August, start of September. Sounds like it's one that I should have gone to see. Too busy. We've got Superman and Fantastic Four coming up. Excitement.
I'm so excited for both of those, honestly. Like, Superman especially, like, I feel like I'm trying not to see too much about it, actually, because I feel like I'm getting dribs and drabs occasionally on, like, social media feeds, and it seems like a lot of the movies out there, and I'm like, no, like, I don't want to see it. Like, I watched, like, the original, like, trailer that came out, which sort of has, like, versions of, like, the original Richard Donner, like, you know, sound, like, you know, song and stuff, and I just get real hype and get real, you know, like fist pump a little bit, and I'm really ready for it, you know. I can't wait. How about yourself, Peter? How are you feeling for these future movies?
Yeah, no, I'm really looking forward to both, because I think the Fantastic Four, we've had plenty of film versions, but maybe never one that I find totally satisfied with. So I keep my fingers crossed that they get this right. And yeah, I'm really excited about Superman. It looks a bit different from the Superman we saw previously, but I quite like that as well. But I'm kind of ready for this sort of more optimistic version of Superman. So fingers crossed.
Excellent stuff. Well, the film club will return, hopefully, after some trips to the cinema. But let us get to the main event. Let's talk about the film that Peter has suggested for us here on the film club. Conrad, take us in.
With Film to Moon.
A 2009 film directed by Duncan Jones, from a story by Duncan Jones, adapted into a screenplay by Nathan Parker, starring Sam Rockwell and Kevin Spacey as the voice of Gertie. Spoiler warning, spoilers for the film Moon to come up. Peter, tell us, for anybody who hasn't seen it, what's the basic setup of Moon?
So Moon is about a low budget science fiction film that kind of follows on in the footsteps of, like, hard sci-fi films from the 70s. So we're sort of saying Silent Running Alien, Outland as well, I believe. It focuses on Sam Bell, who's played by Sam Rockwell, and he has had a very lonely job of manning the Sarang mining station on the far side of the moon. So this is almost a fully automated station, which is mining helium-3, which is basically now the only fuel that the Earth uses. So it's an incredibly important station. But such is the level of sophistication, it only needs one person to sort of keep an eye on it for maintenance. He's a sort of blue-collar guy. He's been, you know, he's doing his best to keep himself sane. You know, obviously 3 years on your own is going to drive me slightly peculiar, but he's sort of keeping it together. And he's coming to the end of his three-year time there, and he's looking forward to going home to see his wife and he meet his daughter, who he hasn't met before. And he's had very limited contact. But when he goes to sort out one of the issues with the automated harvesters on the surface of the moon, there's an accident, and he makes a shocking discovery. And he gets rescued by a slightly younger version of himself, and he discovers that he is in fact a clone of the original Sam Bell, and is in a succession of clones who have been looking after that station for a very long time. So he was never going to go back home. He discovers that he would have been disposed of, and the clones actually only have a three-year lifespan, so his health is deteriorating. And the film is really about how the two clones get along and try and deal with this obviously slightly mind-blowing facts. It's a wonderful sort of smaller story set in a utilitarian sort of sci-fi world. You know, this isn't Star Trek, this isn't Star Wars. It's functional, it's slightly stark. You see, it's a bit like the Nostromo, it's functional rather than pretty, which is what you get with a lot of modern science fiction. For me, it's my favourite Sam Rockwell performance, because it really shows his range. He's always had a lot of energy, but he has to sort of make these two different versions of the same person distinctive. And he does that really, really amazingly. Obviously, one is 3 years older. He's clearly been on some sort of journey. You know, the film kind of hints at, like, Sam has had some anger issues and he's had time to think about it while he's been on the surface of the moon. Whereas the new clone who saved him doesn't. And it's that interplay between those two characters that I really love.
And Conrad, I feel like I should have the Space Finner 2000 air horns ready, because it's clones.
It's clones. Oh, no. Every time, you know.
Those pesky clones.
All these Sam Rockwells and things like that. You know, it's the episode of Red Dwarf where we couldn't afford a guest star, so we're doing trick camera photography again. You know, that kind of stuff.
That's amazing. Some of my favorite stuff.
Yeah. No, there's like, I really love, yeah, especially just all of the, it does feel like Duncan Jones is, like, as a director, is just having some fun with, like, you know, having the two Sam Rockwells interact with each other and stuff. It must be the production must have been interesting, because when you think about him having these conversations, so much of it must have been him talking to himself, like these heartfelt conversations, either with another version of himself that's presumably filmed at a different time, or with Kevin Spacey, who plays who's like the other basically character in this movie, who plays Gertie, this sort of like not like sort of like console, like not even really a robot, but kind of like a console and a mechanical arm with like some emojis basically that just kind of moves around and stuff, and presumably is like maybe Kevin Spacey's there off screen or something, you know, like standing out of frame, like reading his lines or something, but probably not. I'd guess. So like, you know, so much of it would be him doing things like on his own and then put back together and stuff. And they do a lot of like, you know, we've got doubles, so we're going to have sort of some of these, you know, they get in a fight at one point, they play ping pong, that kind of stuff, you know, that you sort of like. you know, we're having fun with this as well as telling this interesting story, definitely. But yeah, and it is, you know, so much. If you took out like maybe, yeah, if you took like, this is a 90-minute film, and if you could take out maybe 60 minutes of the emotional stuff and have there be like a 30-minute, like just clone stuff, that would be a tight future shock in here, you know.
Yeah, it definitely reminds, like, because it's such a small scale story in some respects. It always gave me that vibe as well. I think that's what sort of was my original sort of connection to it. Like, because it is, as you say, longer, it does get a chance to explore it. Like, I think if it was a Future Shock, it would just be the twist that there would be, he's a clone.
Yeah. Or first page would be, he's a clone. Second page would be, there's lots of clones or something like that, yeah. You know?
Oh, totally. Yeah. So I just love all that as well, but it does have time to breathe in it as well. So you mentioned Red Dwarf. Does actually have like a Red Dwarf connection, because they use some of the sets are from like a proposed Red Dwarf film, I think.
Really?
So, yeah. So like some of the sleeping, I think it's the sleeping bay, and when they go down and discover all the, there's like rows and rows of clones, that's from Red Dwarf. So, which I
that's
love.
Wild.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I believe that's right. Yes. The freezer, the endless freezer full of the next clones to be used, all in their plastic bags ready to go, are all in that's a Red Dwarf set, yeah, apparently.
It's amazing.
An unused Red Dwarf set.
Small sci-fi world, I guess.
Indeed, yeah, absolutely. So, maybe that was one of the reasons why I loved it initially, because I obviously love Red Dwarf. But it's just, So, I mean, the other 2000s connection is like clones, obviously, and his Rogue Trooper, which is obviously probably the ultimate 2000s clone story, and they explore very much the same themes, like, are clones people? How should we treat them? And how, you know, what does it say about humanity if it treats clones like this? And there's definitely an element of that. So I think going throughout the film itself as well.
So I'm going to ask you about the mood and tone of this film, particularly possibly compared to what we were talking about with Thunderbolts. But before we do that, one of the things I noticed on my rewatch last week was how the first part of the film almost plays like a ghost story, in that Sam is having some psychological issues. He's sort of seeing things. And that I quite like that. I'm thinking, oh, yeah, are we going to get a bit of a ghost story again? Mm. And then, as you say, in the middle we get fun and games with clones, literally games, because as you say, Conrad, they play ping pong against each other.
Yeah.
And then the film does it take a sad turn, or is it just generally sad right from the outset, this film? Peter?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point about the ghosts, because you're never quite sure, until a point, I think the film sort of goes, is it all in his head? And the film sort of goes, no, this is really happening. But yeah, that's definitely a haunted house, eerie vibe to it, isn't there? Sort of, you know, the technology's glitching, and occasionally he thinks, is he seeing something on the screen? Is it sad all the way through? I think so. I think, you know, it probably is, because he's on his own, isn't he? You know, the only person to keep him sane is Kevin's. He's like a computer that sounds like Kevin Spacey. So, I guess he starts a fairly hopeful because he thinks he's going home, and as soon as he realizes he's a clone, it sort of becomes incredibly sad, because all of that is taken away from him. And then a bit later on the film, he calls Earth, doesn't he, to talk. And it's probably the film's heartbreaking moment, isn't it, when he actually talks to his daughter, who he thinks is his daughter, and she's a grown-up. So he's actually been interacting with, like, video recordings from, like, 20 years ago. So, yeah. So, actually, probably it starts off as mysterious, but then moves into sadness, you know, quite quickly, I think.
So, they have a, what's the word? It's not quite a MacGuffin, but they have a sort of setup where the satellite link to Earth is down, so he can only get taped messages and send taped messages.
Yeah.
And obviously they've been, as we find out, they've just been reusing these taped messages that they probably filmed 20 years ago, like you say, Peter, and they keep using them for each clone. But he does manage to finally get a conversation with his grown-up daughter, which is incredibly heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's so sad. It's like, but it's a testament to the film that you do feel that, don't you? I always do anyway.
Well, I was going to say actually that I feel like it's interesting you say that the movie's sad, Aaron, because I ended up feeling like not only that, but like it's got like three or four like distinct shades of sadness, sort of as you go through the movie, basically, because I think you start with the initial one of something I think we could all kind of empathize with of like, you know, imagine you've got a job where you're isolated for 3 years or something like that. Something that, you know, I think, you know, we've all now gotten a taste of maybe, you know, during the lockdowns and stuff like that. But like this sort of idea that like, you know, you can feel that immediate, like, That's sort of like immediately empathizing, you know, like, imagine you have it, you know, you're just sort of what Sam thinks he is, right? You think you're just away from your family, from your friends for 3 years and stuff. And even if there's hope in coming home, just having been there is like, man, that's just like so heartbreaking generally. Like then the crash of finding out that like that he's a clone, that he's not, you know, sort of this disposable commodity, that nothing he understands is real, and like questioning just like the nature of mortality and existence, which is, you know, depressing. And questioning that nature and then knowing that, in fact, like your life is just sort of as a cog in this machine. Fourth one is then finding out that, like, yeah, that he's missed the whole life of his daughter, that his wife has died when he's been away and stuff. And then the final one is sort of this almost like old Yeller kind of thing as like younger Sam has to basically care for the original clone from the movie who's sort of reached the end of his life cycle and is like, you know, really physically and mentally deteriorating. And like, he has to kind of like, you know, get him like to a position where like, you know, he can escape and do all these other things and stuff like that. And so it gives the movie these different flavors kind of as it goes on, as opposed to just sort of one thing over and over again, that I think is, you know, keeps things fresh throughout the running time and stuff.
You've mentioned already, Peter, Sam Rockwell is astonishing in this central dual role as the two clones that we get to see interacting. It's just an extraordinary performance throughout, isn't it? He has to carry the film.
Yeah, it's just such a difficult thing to do. You've got to be the same guy but also different, and the audiences have to be able to understand that. And they obviously, physically, one is young and fit and one is sort of falling apart. But he talks about some of the things he did in it as well. Like he said for the older Sam who's ill, he took like the Ratso Rizzo cough from, was it Drugstore Cowboy?
Midnight Cowboy.
Midnight Cowboy. Sorry, different film. Drugstore Cowboy.
Yeah.
sorry, everyone. To use that. But just that nuance, one is angry and, you know, the other one is sort of, you're right. He's sad. He's had all this ripped away from him, and he's still. But he also has concocted this plan to try to get to Earth as well, hasn't he? I think so. And the other one doesn't really want to have to accept that because he's in a sort of different headspace. So yeah, it's just really an incredible performance, and the fight scene between them is really brilliantly done as well. So where they but even that's sad because he destroys the. He sort of goes on a rampage and destroys the model village that probably, like many Sams, have been working on for a...
Yeah.
I wonder why nobody questioned it, like, oh, who was building that? But, and that, you know, but what's interesting about that is, like, the younger Sam sort of apologises about that later on, and I wonder if that was, like, a sign that he'd actually there was a bit of an emotional growth there with that character as well, that he'd realised he'd made an error. So, yeah. And the film does hint at the reason the original Sam is in space is that he had issues and that actually he'd spent that time. And you see this through the conversations, these rather stills in video conversations he's having with his wife about him having, you know, had he needed that, so almost needed that time to sort of think about what he'd done and grow. So, yeah, there's all those layers to it as well, I think.
It's 97 minutes long. It's very watchable, this film. It is Duncan Jones's first movie, I believe, isn't it?
Yeah.
What do we make of Duncan Jones as a director based on this performance, Conrad?
I mean, you know, like, I remember when this movie came out and, yeah, just sort of hearing about Rockwell's performance, but also just the direction of this sort of, you know, creating this, like, this kind of sci-fi landscape, I guess, or this, you know, making the movie, it feel like a real place, I guess, which I think he does a really good job of. And again, yeah, just bringing forth these characters and stuff. I think Duncan Jones does a great job in directing the film and making it sort of bringing it to life in a really effective way. And it has, like, you know, like I said, sort of all of these, you know, sort of interesting camera tricks with the Sam Rockwells. And obviously on a limited budget, making the special effects and stuff look like halfway decent, which is pretty good also, you know, sort of, you know, for what's certainly a low budget sci-fi movie, there's a, you know, decent amount of, like, rovers running around on the moon and things like that, that are, you know, that look fine. And, like, you know, different, like, yeah, like, you know, readouts and technical displays and all these, like, little, like, pieces of verisimilitude within the, like, the futuristic setting, I guess.
Yeah, Peter, I mean, you know, the model works great, reminds me of Gerry Anderson, but just Duncan Jones to come in so assured and make a film like this that is just such good value in a way. I mean, I don't know what the budget was. It was presumably tiny, but he did a remarkable job. Yeah. How many?
About 5 million, I think. I read somewhere. So
yes,
yeah. The model work is great, and I think, you know, it's not that an older film, is it really? But because it's all model work and actual sets, that gives it a nice sort of tactile feel that sometimes modern films. I mean, the special effects are amazing in modern films. I'm not. Modern films, but I think that extra sort of physical quality does help, and almost like the low budget use of the models does add to that, I think, as well. And there is some digital effects in there, so, and it's all really cleverly done. I also think the music is amazing. Like, I really love Clint Mansell as a sort of a, you know, making music for films, and it's really, it adds to the atmosphere, doesn't it, as well, I think, you know, that sort of, like, the loneliness, the sadness, that is sort of embodied by that music, and I think the music does an awful lot to help tell the story.
Of course, Duncan Jones has gone on to other movies. He made a movie called Mute, which does feature a sort of sequel to this, or at least you hear about the outcome for one of the clones, I think, in that movie, if I remember rightly. Of course, he also made Source Code, a big budget film. We won't spoil the twist reveal in that film, but it does. It wouldn't be out of place as a future shock also, it seems to me. We could play the air horns on that one as well, Conrad.
Always a good time. You know, we got to get these twists. They're important, for sure.
He's clearly, we know Duncan Jones loves 2000 AD. I was going to ask you to make the case, Peter, to, you know, link this to 2000 AD. I think we've sort of done that already. As you say, clones, future shocks, plus Duncan Jones himself. Were there any other links to 2000 AD that you saw?
I quite like the use of, like, Gertie the robot, and, you know, obviously not a robot, he's a computer, sorry, but he's a sort of based in sort of like a robot housing, and of course that's, you know, obviously 2000 AD loves its robots there. What I liked about that is sort of this suggestion all the way through that that it's, he's going to be, it's a bit like HAL from 2001, A especially, that he's going to be a bit dangerous. And it kind of plays on those, he plays on those expectations a little bit. So, yeah. So I guess in the 2000, so I guess going back to 2000 AD, the sort of, the, you know, the use of sort of like the threat of the technology, you know, is all the way through with Gertie. Although really, he gets some, he sort of, in the end, Gertie turns out to be a bit of a hero. So yeah, but that's certainly something you see in 2008 quite a lot.
Yeah, and a robot with an emoji face, Conrad.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that feels so 2000 AD to me, like just the you know, the friendly robot that's just sort of a screen with that's a smiley face and stuff. That feels, yeah, like sort of a computer, like, and just sort of, they don't lean into it too much, but there's just a lot of that sort of like like a corporate future kind of stuff that you see made, you know, and sort of satirizing that sort of, that feels very 2000 AD. Like the movie begins with this sort of ad for the company and like, you know, fusing that, you know, like clean energy with helium-3, mind on the moon, that like, you know, one of these like corporate, like rah-rah commercials for it. That again, sort of having that be about science fiction stuff. Like if there were like two jokes sort of hidden in there, would have been extremely 2000 AD, you know. Like, but as it is, it's only sort of 2000 AD.
Yeah, yeah. So, but it's also interesting that like the Earth is sort of reliant on this one fuel. That is a great science fiction sort of trope, isn't it? Like, as well, which I think, sure, 2000 AD must have used at some point. I can't think of anything at the top of my head, but it's just something that sort of, you know, goes through all of science fiction as well. So I just think he's such a working class blue collar sort of character. He's not like a scientist. He's basically just almost like a caretaker. He's there to fix things when they break down. And I think that connects to a lot of the 2000 AD characters. They're quite often, you know, sort of very grounded, normal characters. You know, I can think about like Strontium Dog. Okay, Johnny Alpha is like this awesome bounty hunter, but a lot of the characters in there, very grounded, normal people. They just happen to be mutants and they just want to live their life, and they've been forced into like an uncomfortable situation. So I think certainly throughout sort of 2000 AD, I think of a number of characters who are just regular Joes thrown into weird circumstances. And I think, you know, I think Sam definitely fits into that bill, really. You know, he's just a normal guy. He just wants a life like everybody else. He's not super ambitious. He's not super clever. He's just a normal person.
And he is blue collar. He seems like a working guy who's working for this strange corporate company that Conrad has mentioned, control everything. And who are seen at one point communicating with the robot when the clones are not supposed to be able to hear them.
Yeah.
Okay, so like I say, it's 97 minutes. It's from 2009. It's by Duncan Jones. I think we've made the case for the connections with 2000 AD. Would we recommend it to 2000 AD readers who have not seen the film or perhaps not seen it recently? Particularly in the build-up to another movie we're going to mention in just a moment. Conrad, what about you? Would you recommend this one?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Moon is a movie that I, you know, without even talking about 2000 AD, is one that I've recommended to people. I think that it's, you know, it's because it's just an interesting movie, and sort of in an era of, you know, where things are so often as sort of these big blockbusters and, you know, sci-fi, you know, special effects extravaganzas and things of that nature. You know, this movie is just a very quiet, like, kind of character study. I mean, literally two or three actors really on screen at any given time, and like, you know, mostly just the same guy twice and stuff is cool stuff, you know. And yeah, the performances and like emotions you get from the film are really great, and it's definitely, yeah, worth a watch generally, and you know, definitely if you're looking for just like something kind of science fictiony, it's a great watch.
Peter, as we say, buoyed up by this wonderful performance by Sam Rockwell, who I think you're right. I don't I can't think of where Sam Rockwell's been much better than this. You'd recommend this film as well, I'm guessing.
It's one of my favourites, so I would recommend it to anyone who hasn't seen it or hasn't seen it in a while. Go back and rewatch it. It's like I say, it's only about 90 minutes or so long, which is unusual in like modern movies. So you know, it's also quite a compact watch.
And if you're here in the UK, when this episode comes out in 2 weeks' time, I believe it's coming onto Amazon Prime as part of the Prime subscription. So you should be able to stream it with your Prime membership if you've got one in a couple of weeks' time. It's obviously easy to find on video on demand at the moment, but you might be able to get it without paying for it in a couple of weeks. So highly recommended. Now, of course, Duncan Jones is, as we all know, busy making or presumably finishing another film that's coming out late this year. We are finally going to see, hopefully, an animated Rogue Trooper movie. I was telling Peter before we started recording, Conrad, at Enniskillen Comic Fest last week, Jerry Finlay Day confirmed that both he and his co-creator, Dave Gibbons, had been invited to visit some of the motion capture filming.
Very nice.
Jerry Finlay Day didn't understand any of it. And when asked what he could tell us about the film, he said, I can't tell you anything because I don't know anything. However, he did confirm that he had been paid. So
that's good. That's what's good. Most important, that's for sure.
Really important.
That's more than other superhero, more than other comic book based movies can say, for sure.
Absolutely, yeah. It's really important creators get paid when their things get translated. Yeah, totally agree.
Obviously, we are excited about this. Do you feel, Conrad, that Rogue Trooper is in safe hands with Duncan Jones?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I feel like a lot of people, I've been pretty excited for this project for a long time. I think I remembered him sort of announcing it like on the internet. I think that was in 2020 also, I think, of just sort of like of him sort of like in his study with like a Rogue Trooper helmet or something like that. I think it does feel like a passion project for him. And, you know, and as someone, you know, I think that we want people to approach the things we like as passion projects as opposed to as paychecks or something. And I think that is definitely a plus. I think it's really interesting that to get Rogue Trooper from this director that's done so many movies that sort of play around with 2000 AD kind of things, be it clone drama, Hero to Moon, or time travel stuff with Source Code or whatever else, is also really like, you know, makes me hopeful that the movie will be good, which is all I'm really hoping for. That's halfway decent, you know.
Peter, are you going to be there opening week, do you think?
If I can be, yeah, definitely. I am very excited. I love Rogue Trooper, so, and I like Duncan Jones's film, so yes, yeah. Fingers crossed.
We are excited. We are hype, Conrad.
Absolutely.
Back to hype, yes.
I like to say, yeah. I wish I knew more about when it was coming out, which seems very vague at this point. You know, like 2 years ago when it said coming in 2025, that seemed reasonable, but like, you know, now it is 2025, and the fact that it's sort of, I don't know, I look at the on the internet and the release date just says 2025. It's like, you know, now's the time to start for us to start getting specific, I guess, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, we would like to have a date, but hopefully we will be talking about a Rogue Trooper movie directed by Duncan Jones on this podcast before too long. The future for Mega City Film Club, it's uncertain. We need some timey-wimey stuff, Conrad.
Absolutely. But, you know, listen, you know, definitely one that when it comes out, you know, if it comes out in theaters or if it's on streaming or whatever else, one that I'm definitely going to try to, you know, I'm planning to see as soon as possible and will be bullying those around me to see as well. You know, sort of we're going to get some numbers for this. I swear, like we'll figure it out. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, Peter, thank you so much for suggesting Moon to us. I don't think I'd watched it since it came out, and so revisiting it was an absolute delight. I'd forgotten how really good it is and amazingly assured for a first film by a director.
Yeah. I do rewatch it every couple of years because it is one of my favourites. So, but actually, I hadn't watched it for a couple of years, so I was quite glad to watch it again.
And a very nice poster design, which will be the cover art for this episode as well, adding to the stylistic choices for this film. Everything about it is great. Fantastic. So that will do us for Film Club for this episode. And let's find out where you can find us all on the net. Obviously, megacitybookclub.com for me. Conrad, where can we find you?
SpaceSpinner2000.com, SpaceSpinner2000 2080 recap podcast. We're steaming our way through 1995. We'll be covering Film Club ground pretty soon, as we ourselves will be talking about the Dread movie, the Stallone Dread movie over there, as we've talked about several times here in the past. And we're having a lot of fun just talking about these classic 2008, this classic 2080 action.
And the forum's getting quite excited about some stories from the mid-90s that are sort of, they're on the edge of the radar. They're coming up not too far away.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, end of 95 into 96 and is sort of a rebirth for 2000 AD a little bit. We'll get the Pit story in Dread. That's one of my favorites. And then 96, we'll start getting to stuff like Sinister Dexter, and then on the horizon there's stuff like Maze World, or even like Nikolai Dante's sort of within reaching distance and stuff like that.
And if I could just recap some of your excitement recently, in a recent episode you were quite hype about the moment where Garth Ennis has Dread pulling himself down off the cross.
Oh my God. Amazing. Like, it's so funny because, we've got a new co-host over there. And so I've been trying not to be super down on things. And I know like historically people are very down on this era of Dread with, both Garth Ennis and, Grant Morrison and Mark Miller, but we've honestly had like a decent amount of fun through a pair of those authors' Dread stories. Both the licorice all sorts of Dread world action with the Crusade storyline, and then Goodnight Kiss, which I think is pretty amazing, just in terms of Dread being badass, which is a great time. Always a good moment for sure.
Fantastic stuff. So that's spacespinner2000.com. Peter, what about your work? Where can we find you on the net?
So I write a blog called The Hindsight Hut, and you can find me on www.thehindsighthut.com. It's a terrible name, but I'm stuck with it now.
Nice. I hear you.
I know. Seemed like a good idea at the time. But I write a very sort of occasional blog about TV, movies, comic books. Sometimes it's interviews, sometimes my own thoughts. So it's when I get the time to do it. So if you're interested in those sort of things, please seek them out. So I did an interview with the comic book author Simon Furman not too long back about what influenced his work rather than just specifically about his comics. That's what I'm quite proud of. So please, if you're interested, please seek that out.
Excellent. Well, all those links will be in the show notes for this episode and at megacitybookclub.com. We three are now off to all check ourselves and make sure that we're not physically deteriorating and that we're not, in fact, a clone, hopefully. And we'll check on those satellite uplinks to our loved ones at the same time. Always got to check, and we've got to have the air horns ready for Conrad just in case.
Never hurts to just take a mental inventory to see if you're a clone or not. Like what would a clone me be doing? Like how would I be different? That kind of stuff. Couldn't hurt you.
Couldn't hurt. Great, Peter. Thanks again. So until next time, I'm Eamon.
I'm Conrad.
And I'm Peter.
And we have been
Mega City Film Club.
Wow.